In this room this evening, we will hear a centennial lecture on equality of educational opportunity. Now, some of you here may have found the wrong room. There's another lecture in the building on stylistic parallels between Dostoevsky and Kafka. If you're interested in stylistic parallels, please go to room D. But on the other hand, if you're... Anybody else? If you're interested in substantive parallels, you might well stay here. In the 100-year history of this university, few problems have been so persistent on the American scene as those associated with assuring that Negroes are able to assume their rightful place in our society. And considering the centrality of the problem to our survival as a reasonably cohesive nation, one can only reflect sadly on the minuscule extent of university involvement with this issue in the past. Our speaker this evening is one of a very small number of scholars who have worked partly in a university context in a search for an appropriate degree of engagement between the university community and pressing this particular pressing societal problem in the larger community. I don't know if any of his remarks this evening will be directed toward this particular issue of the role of the university in the present ferment, but his presence here and your presence here cannot help but reframe the role of this institution as it strives to channel its own resources toward constructive ends that improve education in the urban slums. Very few men, I think, are as well qualified as Dr. Gordon to speak with us about equality of educational opportunity. Some of the present hats that he wears, professor of psychology and education, chairman of the Department of Educational Psychology and Guidance at Yeshiva University in New York. He's assistant research professor of pediatrics at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He's director for the ERIC Center, the Educational Research Information Clearinghouse on the Disadvantaged at Yeshiva University. Some of the hats that he's worn in the past include National Director of Research for Project Head Start, Director of the Harriet Tubman Clinic for Children in Harlem, Chief Psychologist, Department of Pediatric Psychiatry, Jewish Hospital of Brooklyn, Associate Director of the Morningside Community Center and Mental Health Clinic in Harlem. And at one time, I note in his past, he was Assistant Dean of Men at Howard University. My notes say Assistant Dean of Mean. The roles of scholar and social activist have not always entailed functions that many people have been able to bridge with success. The academician committed to a social cause too often either reflects poorly on his scholarship or becomes ineffective in his advocacy of various types of social action. In Dr. Edmund Gordon, and I have been privileged to know Dr. Gordon for several years, we find an individual who has been most successful in demonstrating that the two worlds are indeed compatible. I am sure that no small measure of his success is attributable to his graciousness, his humane outlook, his demeanor, his tact, as well as his wisdom. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of the College of Education and on behalf of the Graduate College Committee for the Centennial Year, it is my privilege to introduce Dr. Edmund Gordon, who will speak tonight to the topic Equalizing the Opportunity to Learn. Dr. Gordon. Uh,
Thank you very much, Dean Atkin. After your very kind introduction, maybe I shouldn't make a speech, but should just say thank you. I'd also like to say thank you for inviting me to help you observe the 100th anniversary of the founding of the University of Illinois. About a year after this university was chartered, February 23rd in 1868 to be exact, my very cherished friend and mentor, the late William E.B. Du Bois, was born. At the turning, or at the turn of the century, it was he who predicted that the problem of the 20th century would be the problem of the color line. And if his use of the term color line can be interpreted to refer to the social and economic disenfranchisement of persons of low social class as well as persons of low ethnic caste, then Du Bois was correct. The problems which adhere in our persistence in affording negative differential opportunity to people who are arbitrarily identified with certain social classes or ethnic caste status, these problems have emerged as crucial national and international problems of this period. These problems are developmental, economic, educational, political, and social. As educators, our concerns are primarily with the educational and developmental aspects of the problem. However, in looking at problems in education or in the equalization of opportunities to learn, we will be forced to look beyond matters which are purely educational. Fortunately, the social forces which create problems for men tend also to provide the impetus and sometimes the means for their solution. In the examination of these developmental and educational problems in this broader context, we may find more appropriate leads for their solution. Our concern with equalizing educational opportunity is in part a product of certain advances made in the organization and development of human societies during the past six centuries. The concept and concern for its implementation could not have emerged as an important issue at this time if we had not earlier developed an awareness of the universality of educability. In the history of man, assumed educability, that is, the educability of human subjects, has reflected the level of society's demand for people, that is, workers, capable of certain levels of function. Human societies have always considered educable those categories of persons thought to be needed for meaningful participation in the maintenance of the social order. In more simplistic and exclusive social systems, most people were considered uneducable, and effort was not, quote, wasted on their formal education. At one point in history, it was only the religious and political nobility who were thought to be capable and worthy of academic training. The social order was maintained by the machinations of these elite groups and the simple and routine gaming, farming, and crafting skills of illiterate masses. Under the dual pressures of the Reformation in religion and industrialization in commerce, categories of persons thought to be capable of academic learning were greatly expanded. Opportunities for active participation in religious activities and rituals made reading and writing more widely usable and marketable skills. Similarly, the emergence of collective machine production in shops and the expansion of commerce and trade through institutions made necessary the broader distribution of these skills. The combined impact was to create greatly increased societal need for formal computational and communicative skills in larger numbers of people. As a corollary, previously illiterate people were drawn into the small body of literates, and the mass of uneducables was reduced. In the United States, where religious freedom or diversity spread, where democracy and government became the ideal, and where industrialization and economic expansion advanced most rapidly, more and more literate persons were required. In mid-19th century USA, our society's view of who could be educated quickly expanded to include all people in this country except slaves. With the end of slavery and the incorporation of ex-slaves into the industrial force, ex-slaves became regarded as educable. They, together with uneducated but not unintelligent poor whites, began to expand the public school as a vehicle for their education. These indigenous poor were later joined by waves of immigrants who also saw the public school as their major vehicle for upward mobility. In the metropolitan areas of that period, the school also became the major vocational training resource through which semi-skilled and commercial workers were prepared for our rapidly expanding industries. Indeed, the school did not succeed in educating all of these new candidates for education. But once the narrowly defined concept of educability was broadly defined and nearly universal in its inclusiveness. Not only has the concept of educability changed over the years, but so has our concept of education. In Thomas Jefferson's view, the school was expected to provide the technical skills and basic knowledge necessary for work and economic survival. It was from the press, newspapers, journals, and books, and from participation in politics that people were to be really educated. In reviewing Jefferson's position on education, Crimmin has concluded that it never occurred to Jefferson that schooling would become the chief educational influence on the young. However, changes in the functioning of the society and changes in the nature of the skills and competences required by the social order have also changed the nature of education. By the middle of the 19th century in this country, public schools that served the upper classes or in their service to children from upper class families had developed curriculums which were foundational to a liberal education. While this stream continued, the latter half of that century and the first half of the 20th century were marked by a high degree of proliferation in the development of technical and vocational training programs. Preparation for the liberal arts was considered a luxury and was even thought by some to be relatively useless. It was the Jeffersonian concept of utilitarian education which prevailed. And it was this utilitarian education which came to be the mode in our view of universal educability. Everybody can and should be taught to do useful work, to hold a job. Now, in the course of my discussion, we'll return to this concern with the liberating arts. But for the moment, our concern is with the protean nature of the concept educability. It was out of these concepts of universal educability and education as the vehicle for upward mobility that early and continuing struggles for equality of educational opportunity have developed. In this country, the battle was first waged to establish public responsibility for education of citizens in states where public education did not exist. This was followed by the struggle for adequate educational facilities. It was not until the century was a third spent, that is, this century was a third spent, that the struggle for equal though separate schools was engaged. By mid-century, it was clear that separate schools in our society are intrinsically unequal. However, even before the 1954 Supreme Court desegregation decision was promulgated, it was also clear that racially mixed or integrated education does not necessarily ensure education of high quality. The early 60s brought the campaign for quality integrated education. And here in the mid-60s, we hear the plea for quality education, where possible, integrated education, where necessary, compensatory education. and in many settings, quality black education by and for black people, but always for education of high quality leading to equality of educational achievement for all groups in our society. The introduction of the concept compensatory grew out of the recognition that learners who do not begin from the same point may not have comparable opportunities for achieving the goal when they are provided with equal or similar educational experiences. Rather, to make the opportunity equal for kids who have been handicapped, it is often necessary to make their education something more than equal. It may be necessary to compensate for the handicaps even while we are providing education of equal quality. It may be necessary to change the educational method and the model in order to meet the learning style, the learning needs of youngsters who come to school out of different backgrounds of experience. Now, out of this concern with equalizing educational opportunity, some thoughtful persons have begun to think about what the criterion should be. This became a problem of critical importance when Congress placed on the Office of Education the responsibility for determining the status of equal opportunity for education in the United States. James Coleman, the principal investigator for that study, has taken as his criterion equality of educational achievement, arguing that it is one of the functions of the school to make academic achievement independent of personal background. This view holds that the effective and adequate school experience should enable youngsters from differential backgrounds to reach the same levels of academic achievement. When the schools do not do this, they are failing to provide equal educational opportunity, and they have failed to compensate for the variations in background experiences of the youngsters through the school's program. Ralph Tyler takes a different position. Tyler has argued that since children come to school with different abilities, the criterion should be that the learning process continue, that it continue to progress even though the rate may not be equal to that of other children. For Tyler, the teacher should be held responsible for ensuring that learning takes place and that something is learned as long as the child is in school. In this view, the learning experience is adequate and the opportunity equal so long as increments in learning continue. Stadalski and Lesser, writing from Harvard, have advanced a view of the equality of educational opportunity, which is in part based on Lesser's having found differential patterns of intellective function distributed by ethnic group identification. These investigators argue that it is the function of the school to provide equal educational opportunity for maximum development of each group or individual, whether or not group differences remain, enlarge, or disappear as a consequence of the learning experience. Equal opportunity is thus provided if the school makes maximum educational use of the distinctive pattern of ability the child possesses. Lesser would argue then that the school ought to be trying to produce possibly more architects among youngsters with Oriental backgrounds, since he has determined in his investigations that these youngsters tend to have greater ability in spatial relationships. Or maybe a group that has stronger ability in the verbal area ought to produce more lawyers or more lecturers. There is a more classical view, most recently advanced by Kenneth Clark. This view holds that it is possible to identify certain features of good education. Education which includes the best expression of these features should be made available to all children alike. Clark believes that if just that goal could be achieved, we shall have moved a long way toward the achievement of equality of educational opportunity. Clark has expressed displeasure with the concept compensatory education because he feels it places an unnecessary stigma on the disadvantaged youngster, since it suggests certain kinds of deficits that this youngster brings to school and tends to account for the poor school achievement on the basis of these pupil deficits and not on the basis of school deficits. All of these views have some merit. The adoption of any one or combination would significantly improve the quality of educational opportunities available. However, each has some limitation. The view which I have identified, with which I've identified Coleman, and one that I advanced back in 1963, is that it is the role of the school to eliminate diversity. On more careful reflection, it is probably more appropriate to characterize the purpose of the school as that of amplifying and enhancing diversity. I now have to back away from Coleman's view and my earlier position. I'm not sure that we should be as much concerned with equalizing the product as with guaranteeing the achievement of a baseline function for all youngsters and with amplifying diversity, since obviously there are differences in the functional potential of individuals. The Stodolsky lesser position generates considerable trouble for me because it may lure us into a racial ethnic group determined set of behavioral characteristics. It could lock us into a position with respect to the genetic origin of such differences, and I would have some trouble with that position. I think that the relevance of genetic factors to the educational problems of these youngsters probably has been approached incorrectly. Coming out of a society that has been organized around scarcity, we have never felt that we have enough of anything to go around. This scarcity approach to the economy has also influenced education. Because of that, we have used our genetic theories not to identify ways of optimizing development of individuals, but to identify ways of distributing the resources of the society. In education, we have assumed that because certain patterns occur in high frequency in certain groups, we could explain differential clustering of these patterns on the basis of genetic factors. We have used the genetic factors and the corresponding evidence that comes from our psychological performance and achievement data to assign persons to certain categories of educational service. Now, without rejecting the possibility that some stocks of animals or human beings do have differential characteristics, these same data could be used to prescribe the nature of educational intervention, the nature of the educational intervention necessary to optimize the development of such persons. Certainly a more human and progressive approach to education than is one that uses these data to classify and assign with respect to likelihood that they will succeed in the existing system. The Stodolsky lesser position, as I have indicated, tends to push us into too great a support for genetically determined patterns of functioning, which I cannot reject, but have tried to reinterpret. I suspect the fact that a youngster comes to the school situation with a pattern of strengths, weaknesses, and style that may be somewhat atypical to the pupil abilities pattern the school is most accustomed to work with. But this simply means that the school is now more greatly challenged to design learning experiences that build upon these particular patterns in meeting first the survival needs of pupils and second the learning satisfaction needs. If the youngster also can or chooses to have a particular area of competence or potential amplified, then the function of the school is to amplify that. The lesser position and the Tyler position leave a bit too much room for our settling for too little based upon an underestimation of potential. Tyler recognizes that children come to school at different levels, with different backgrounds, and would argue that it is the function of the school simply to ensure that each child learns at his own pace and functions in his own way. There is a danger in this laissez-faire approach to education, because we are likely to estimate what is his own way and what is his own potential in our traditional ways. These traditional ways have often been subject to gross underestimation of potential, since we have generally measured potential for intellectual functioning along two narrow dimensions. The Clark position would be more acceptable if we knew that all children learned in much the same manner, and if we had achieved a higher level of pedagogical competence. I cannot settle for the best we currently practice when that practice is so often unsuccessful, even with middle-class white children. I'm also troubled by a definition which is only concerned with the alleged input and takes no cognizance of the output. In other words, Clark says that we have good schools in this country. Let us make our schools, all of our schools, good schools. Now, I can't reject that as an idea, since I favor good schools. But I'm suggesting that if one is concerned with equalizing educational opportunity or with compensating for variations that youngsters bring to school, then simply taking the best available model may not be enough. Let us return to the purpose of education in a democratic society. If that purpose is to broaden opportunities for meaningful participation in the mainstream of society through the development of necessary skills, competences, and credentials, then educational opportunity is unequal unless it does just that for all learners. At any point in the history of society, the minimum educational goals are defined by the prerequisites for meaningful participation in the economic, social, and political life of the society. The educational experience can and should enable many persons to go far beyond the development of such, shall we call them, survival skills and competences. But it cannot be considered to have provided equal opportunity unless it enables all to reach the survival or participation level. Now, in the emerging period, these survival or participation skills and competences include at least five areas. The first of these I've identified as mastery of basic communication skills. While physical strength and manual skill represented man's basic tools for survival in years past, it is increasingly clear that communication skills have emerged as the survival tool of the future. Education for all persons in our society must be built upon the mastery of basic skills and symbolic representation and the utilization of symbols. Such skills include speech, reading, writing, and arithmetic computation. A second tool of survival, somewhat less critical than the basic skills, but of central importance, is skill in the movement from anxiety, confusion, and disorder to problem formulation, competence in problem identification and problem solving, utilizing inductive and deductive logic and the scientific method in bringing experimentation to bear upon the solution of problems. Knowledge of physical, biological, and social sciences is becoming so vast as to preclude complete content mastery. Knowledge of the dimensions of these fields, mastery of the principles upon which they are based, skill in the discovery of order or patterns, skill in the creation of order, and competence in the management of information and utilization of knowledge are then urgent survival tools in this area. With work losing its place as man's central preoccupation, as we move to higher levels of technological development and automation, man is freed for more essentially human activities. Such freedom increases the demand for competence in self-management and interpersonal relationships. Achievement of this goal will require meaningful understanding of self and others. effective utilization and control of self, adaptation to a multi-ethnic and multicultural world, conflict resolution through avenues of nonviolence, and the development of an appreciative and respectful relationship with the world of nature, of man-made objects, of ideas, and of values. Theobald sees the world of the future as one in which achievement through physical work will no longer be a positive norm in society, and utilization of leisure will emerge as man's central problem. Rapidly changing technology will preclude the lifetime career in a single vocation. Today's children, as adults, will often change not only jobs, but the kinds of work they will be required, the kinds of work they will do, and will be required to make quick adaptation to radically different work situations. The demand will be for trainability and continuing education throughout one's lifespan. If some of the projections hold true, today's young people as adults will live in a society which is no longer work-oriented. The new society may reward instead self-expression through art, nature, social interchange, and ideation as art forms. Thus, the fifth educational goal involves education for continued learning and creative self-expression, not so much for vocational utilization as for aesthetic satisfaction. Within these broad goals, differential levels of learning achievement must be achieved, but need not be based on ethnic or social origins. Achievement will reflect variations in the quality of intellect found in all individuals in our society. Democratically administered, educational facilities coupled with enlightened educational practice should ensure this development. Equality of the opportunity to learn should achieve at least these goals in all pupils, with the possible exception of 3 to 5% who may be truly regarded as mentally defective. It must achieve these goals through whatever route or special style or special ability or special background the child may bring to the school. Pedagogy, as a scientific profession, must, like medicine, modify its treatment modalities to meet the requirements of the individual being served, and as medicine's goals are physical survival and health, the goals of pedagogy must be social survival and competence. In the absence of the achievement of these goals, it has not provided an equal opportunity to learn. Now, over the past 10 years, a number of special programs have emerged for upgrading the education of disadvantaged children, or equalizing educational opportunity, or compensating for the disadvantages these youngsters enter school with. These programs have been dubbed compensatory education. This is a term which has come into use since 1960, and it refers to the pedagogical efforts directed at overcoming or circumventing assumed deficiencies in background and function or experiences of children from economically deprived, culturally isolated, or ethnically segregated families. A wide variety of elements have been introduced under this banner. They include modifications in the training, recruitment, and utilization of staff. Remedial reading and language development have been heavily stressed. Enrichment and modification of curriculum has been tried. Expanded guidance services have been provided. Enriched extracurricular activities have been instituted. Increased parental and peer involvement. Extended reciprocal involvement of school and community. Particular emphasis has been given to the prevention and salvaging of school dropouts and to the preparation for school through preschool programs. Although most of these programs are concentrated on improved or increased cognitive input, some have sought to introduce affective experiences or affect-laden materials designed to improve self-concept and motivation. Unfortunately, despite the wide acceptance of compensatory education models and the enthusiasm with which some of these programs have been heralded, when one looks at their impact on academic performance in the target population, it is obvious that compensatory education, as presently practiced, is either insufficient or irrelevant to the needs of disadvantaged young people who are not making it in academic settings. There are some aspects of compensatory education which seem to have promise for some children. There are other aspects, projected and not yet tried, which would logically seem to have good potential for success. Some of these more promising elements are in the direction of what we might expect of excellent programs of education. Others are in the direction of what we might expect of a good and humane social order. Both of these ideals obtainable goals are costly in terms of material resources. They're costly in terms of humanitarian concern. However, they may be prohibitive in costs in competition with distorted national values. The rather modest success of these efforts at compensatory education, when combined with the Coleman findings indicating that school factors account for a small amount of the variation in school achievement, could lead to the conclusion that improvements in the quality of education are hardly worth our effort. But just as the Coleman findings are based upon an examination of several factors which are probably not crucial in the determination of the quality of education, of the quality of education, much that we see in the several approaches to compensatory education consist of educational features which may be necessary to the educational process, but evidently are not sufficient to make the difference in terms of greatly improved academic achievement in socially disadvantaged children. Most of these programs have either attempted to modify cognitive processes, to change level of content mastery, or to change the motivation of the young people served. However, most of these programs represent vast increases in the quantity of effort directed at improving function, but very little improvement in the quality of program offered. The efforts directed at changed cognitive function are very traditional and have brought little that is new or changed in pedagogy. One does not see in these programs any reflection of current thinking relative to learning theory and behavioral organization. With but one exception, there is no representation in the programs I have reviewed of the application of behavioral analysis and contingency management to the learning experiences of these youngsters. Yet, this is one of the few approaches to compensatory education which seems to be bearing fruit. In approaching improved content mastery, the programs seem to have concentrated either on an enriched or watered-down presentation of material to pupils. Again, drastic reorganization in the presentation of material, the quality of material, and the conditions under which materials are presented are not routinely present in programs of compensatory education. At the level of increased motivation and attitude change, we have somewhat more promising signs in the efforts of many of these programs. Several programs have sought more active involvement of parents and representatives of the communities from which these children come in the planning and conduct of educational experiences. This emphasis, however, is by no means a widely accepted or dominant one. At least at the level of meaningful participation, there continues to be strong resistance on the part of the education establishment. This has been particularly exhibited in recent struggles between school personnel and community groups. Despite the tradition of community control of the public school, when that control is likely to pass in the hands of poor and minority group persons, the school resists strongly. If compensatory education is to compensate for the learning problems of young people who are thought to come to the school without necessary backgrounds of experience to optimally benefit from the school, or of youngsters who come to the school poorly motivated for the goals of the school, or to help youngsters who come to the school lacking certain cognitive habits and skills, there are some criteria which might guide the development of an adequate approach to equalization of educational opportunity. The first of these is effective instructional programs and practices. If this is to be achieved, we will need to give greater attention to the dynamics of group interaction in the relationship, or in their relationship, to the teaching-learning process. Professionals concerned with such fields as psychotherapy and decision process have developed elaborate systems of theory and practice based upon concepts from group dynamics. This sophistication has not yet been appropriately applied in education. Effective instruction will also require that we explore different ways of organizing learning experiences to meet individual differences in readiness and style. Readiness and style may vary with respect to the functional capacity to discriminate between things. They may vary with respect to habit patterns that have been established around these sensory functions. They may vary based upon the dominance of one aspect of sensory function over another. It may well be that children whose life experiences vary drastically may also have significant variations in the hierarchical organization of sensory function and response modalities. Furthermore, if individuals, independently of experience or station of life, differ with respect to the degree to which they are inclined to respond with one or another sense of the senses, it may be that one of the significant variables in learning ability and disability is the quality of support provided when the learning task presented does not complement the sensory organization of the learner. We know from some of our work in special education that where youngsters have impairments in crucial sensory areas, other areas are able to be utilized if appropriate supports are provided while the shift is being made. Another emphasis deserving attention is our effort at more effective instruction involves the utilization of behavioral analysis and contingency management in the design of learning experiences. In another context, I have stressed the importance of qualitative as opposed to quantitative analysis of intellectual or other behavioral functions as a prerequisite for the development of prescriptions for learning. In behavioral analysis, one is concerned with the detailed analysis and description of behavioral function, so that strength, weaknesses, weakness, style, preference, etc., are identified, and a course of action for directed learning may be established. In contingency management, one is concerned with limiting the contingencies surrounding behavior so that the possible outcomes can be controlled, making possible the anticipation of consequences of behavior. Such understanding and manipulation permit us to tie consequences of behavior to the antecedents of behavior and to use these consequences as reinforcers of desired behaviors. If effective instructional programs can be achieved, compensatory education will need to reach children earlier, serve them over longer periods of the day, week, and year, and possibly follow them longer in life. This latter need may increase as the need for continued learning and instruction as lifetime processes become more accepted in our society. The program then must provide for intensive and extensive care from the cradle at least until productive work or college. In many instances, it will need to provide through the school child care and instructional services 10 to 12 hours a day, 6 or 7 days a week, and 12 months out of the year. If we are concerned with insulating the child from many of the destructive elements in disorganized communities and troublesome homes, there is little choice but to drastically expand the periods for which the school is responsible for the child. This enriched school experience will have little effect unless it can come to be valued and respected by the children and the families served. Unless involvement in the school and respect for its values can become positive norms in the lives of children, the productiveness of the school will be impaired. There is mounting evidence suggestive of the relationship between goal determination and task involvement. It would appear that participation in the determination of the policies of schools which these children attend by their parents and community members with whom they identify would be positively reflected in increased commitment to the objectives and programs of the school. A corollary of this involvement is another attitudinal asset, the increasingly recognized sense of environmental control. Would seem also to be a potential product of this increased involvement in decision-making in school affairs. Participation in decision-making is by no means the only road to personal involvement. Of equal importance is the need that the school, the curriculum, and the materials it uses provide points of identification for the learner. In this connection, materials which are more widely representative of the variety of cultural, economic, and ethnic groups in this country are essential. Staff members who also represent this variety of backgrounds are a necessary ingredient. If the school is to meet the special needs of youngsters who are handicapped by lower economic status, special attention and provision will need to be made to protect and ensure good health, adequate nutritional status, and material resources necessary for effective school learning. In some instances, this will mean elaborate programs of health care. In other situations, food supplements will be required. In many situations, stipends may be necessary to enable the youngster to provide the necessary supplementary school materials and pocket money for minimal social interaction. For these children, the school must alleviate or circumvent economic, cultural, social, experiential, and educational deficiencies in their environment. Many of these are functions the school was not originally designed to perform. The influence of the school is by no means limited to the period during which the youngster is responsible to the school. What the youngster perceives as opportunity to utilize the school's products and to participate in the mainstream of the society may be as important to his adjustment and progress within the school as it is to his development in post-school periods. Again, in reference to the all-important sense of environmental control, it may be that in the absence of perceived opportunity to do something with his life, all of our innovations and educational improvements will be for naught. Since so much of the school's influence is mediated through verbal interaction, its program for these children will have to reflect respect for the languages with which these children come to the school. In some instances, basic education may have to be provided in the vernacular of the child until development has progressed to a point where a transition to standard English forms may be achieved. Since high degrees of mobility and transiency are characteristic of this population, special provision to accommodate transiency must be made. This may require comparability of basic goals and programs at each level of instruction and sufficient intimacy in teacher-pupil relations to provide for emotional and physical security, particularly at points of transition. This goal may be partially achieved through the provision of sufficiently small organizational units so that each child is enabled to achieve a sense of identity and involvement in the essential aspects of the educational process. In this setting, the child will need to experience a real sense that what he does and what he decides can influence his progress and his achievement in the situation at hand. The implementation of programs which approach these criteria will to a large extent depend upon the availability of excellent school staffs. In the achievement of this goal, special attention will need to be given to the preparation, supervision, and the circumstances of work of school personnel. The dimensions of the necessary training program have not yet been specified. Wide variations are possible in the backgrounds and training of persons utilized if emphasis is placed upon supervision and accountability. Particularly in these schools, non-professionals and paraprofessional indigenous to the backgrounds from which children come should be utilized. And these persons, like all other staff members, should be actively represented along with non-school employed members of the target community in the decision-making in all aspects of the school's functioning. The school must be adequately provided for in terms of material, financial, and human resources. For the target population, school facilities and resources do make a difference. Despite the Coleman finding that school facilities were relatively unimportant, you will remember from that study that he also points to the fact that for Negro youngsters, for youngsters from poor families, the quality of schools, the quality of teachers do account for a reasonable portion of the variation in function. There must be available, then, the monetary and status rewards necessary to attract and hold able teachers in classroom instruction. These teachers must have a wealth of materials from which to draw and the physical facilities necessary to make countless variations in the way learning experiences are presented. Cultural, economic, ethnic integration in education are often viewed as alternatives to compensatory education. Increasingly, they must be viewed as integral parts of compensatory or quality education, probably more efficient than the provision of all the above stated factors would be the mixing of children from more limited backgrounds in classes where the majority of pupils come from more privileged circumstances of life. Instead of a choice between integration and compensatory education, integration should be regarded as an essential feature of compensatory education. However, if we are forced into a choice between compensatory education as currently practiced and school integration, it appears that school integration at our present level of knowledge and practice is the preferred treatment. To dichotomize this issue, however, is an error. One should not be forced to choose the treatment which will provide the greatest gain, but rather the treatments necessary to achieve the goal. There is increasing conviction that just as compensatory education may be insufficient, ethnic integration in the school is also insufficient. Clearly, where youngsters come to a learning situation with different backgrounds and different degrees of readiness, we have no choice but to institute educational programs which build upon and compensate for their functional characteristics. At the same time, since we know that a large measure of pupil functioning seems to be influenced by non-cognitive factors related to the social, psychological circumstances under which they study, the school also has responsibility for the manipulation of those circumstances to serve the learning needs of the pupil. In this instance, the provision of learning experiences in the context of culturally, economic, ethnically integrated pupil groupings is indicated. Even if compensatory education could do the job, some leaders have cautioned against dropping the demand for integration. They feel it is only the threat of racial integration which will lead the white majority to provide the resources we need to do an acceptable job of compensatory education. We recall that it was the threat of racial mixing that pushed the Southern white power structure of the 1940s and 1950s to equalize at least the educational facilities available to Negroes. We wish that this estimate of the nation's values were wrong. But given the inhumanity of our destructive defense of autocracy and corruption masquerading as democracy in Vietnam, the immorality of our pursuit of a military victory when the problems there are clearly political and social, and given the financial drain and waste involved in that military effort, the disadvantaged of our nation would be wise to expect little gratuitous assistance. Equalizing the opportunity to learn is not yet of high priority in this country. Unfortunately, we will for a while fail to adequately educate more than a third of our school population. We will continue to reap the bitter harvests of frustration, resentment, and alienation from our poverty-stricken minority groups. We will have more strife and conflict and riots. We will have louder cries for black power and more resistance from white power. All of this will occur even if tonight we suddenly found solutions to the school's problems in equalizing the opportunity to learn. Because these are not just school problems. They are not simply problems of inadequate school resources or inadequate pedagogical materials or inadequate pedagogical organization and procedures. The issues involved in the underdevelopment of one third of our human resources reflect basic problems in the values and the morality of our nation. But let me hasten to assure you that I am not as pessimistic as I may sound. I continue to be optimistic. We are learning in Vietnam the limitations of the exercise of military power. We are learning through developments in Britain and France the limitations in the exercise of economic power. We are learning in Newark and Detroit the limitations in the exercise of violent expressions of black power. We are learning through the growing rebellion of black people limitations in the exercise of the power of human exploitation. We have yet to learn on all of these fronts and others the power of human development, the power of human concern, the power of human compassion. But life has a way of forcing man to deal with the reality, and in this confrontation with reality, life has a way of forcing our continued movement toward new and higher forms of human and humane social organization. I think Jefferson was right. The schools are responsible for the development of certain areas of skill and competence and understanding, but it is in the social, economic, and political interaction that the general education and development of the populace occur. Whether we choose it so or not, the societal process is moving in the direction of equalization of opportunity to learn, to develop, and to participate. We can accelerate or retard the process, we can facilitate or interfere, but we cannot stop it. M.C. Otto has captured my view of the direction of our development in his little volume, The Human Enterprise, and I quote from it. He writes, "As I recall similar instances in the past and contemplate what is taking place in our own day, I think of a black oak that I have long admired. It rises 70 or 80 feet into the air, a thing of rugged beauty every day of the year and every hour of the day. Whether seen in the searching light of noon or in the mellow colors of sunset, whether barely visible as a dim mass on a dripping, sultry night, or clearly etched against the sky at dawn, each recurring presence arouses a fresh sense of the oak tree's greatness as an achievement of life, and intimates anew something of that unfathomable mystery we call nature, that complexity of being into which every living thing sends its roots. But it is not the impressiveness of the oak which just now brings it to mind, not its strength or dignity or beauty. It is its behavior in autumn and winter, if a tree may be said to behave. Unlike the maples and the hickories in the same grove, it refuses to give up its leaves. Rains, snows, winds have no effect. The tug of the elements is powerless to bring them down. They change from green to red, then to the color of the marshes when the winter's snow are first gone. They wrinkle, they dry up, they rustle in the breeze, but they do not release their grip. They linger through the winter as memories of departed days haunt the mind of a man whom a change of fortune has retired from active life. Then comes spring. In March, The leaves appear to be thinning out, and before April ends, they are gone. What rains and snows and winds and blustering from without could not do, the quiet prod of life working from within does with ease, as the sun climbs higher in the zodiac, and the responsive sap ascends the tree trunk and ramifies into the branches and twigs, the clinging leaves drop away. For new leaves do not come because old leaves have fallen. The old leaves fall because new leaves are coming. Or to speak more accurately, because the life cycle of the tree turns from sustaining old leaves to developing new ones. It is true of the oak and true of the tree of life.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gordon, for a most perceptive and comprehensive address. I wonder if any members of the audience would care to raise questions or comments.